You're listening to the Heroes Podcast Network.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Red Shirts and Runabouts. I am your host, Derek, and I have two guests with me who are returning for the third week in a row.
Woo!
One of you's more excited than the other. So Zach.
Hello.
And Ray.
Hi.
And we are here to review Star Trek Insurrection, the third TNG era film. Last 2 weeks, we reviewed Generations and First Contact, respectively.
Let me guess. Next week, we're going to do Nemesis.
That's crazy. I don't know why you did think that.
Next week, we're going to do the one with the whales.
Yes.
Next week is Nemesis, yes.
So, funny story about the whale one. First time I watched it.
That's the official title. Star Trek. The whale one.
It is the one that I forget the name most.
The Voyage Home.
I watched it with you two. And another guy, Timmy. And Zach and Timmy talked throughout the entire movie, and Derek was so upset that he took a sip of water, the loudest sip I've ever heard, slammed it down and said, I just want to watch the whale movie! And we didn't talk since.
Oh, God. Good memories.
We've spoken since then.
We spoke today before recording.
Anyway, so this week we're reviewing Star Trek Insurrection. Normally we would do some news first, but I'm not really aware of any interesting Star Trek news over the last week. So
it's kinda still a thing.
Yeah.
Star Trek's still a franchise.
It's coming. They really blew the news wad last week.
I know. Yeah. There's not much going on this week, which is fine.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's that. So we'll just dive in, I guess, to Insurrection. One thing I want to point out before, as we kind of begin here, is when I watched it, rewatched it this past week, I just was talking to Ray and I mentioned that, you know, their budget had been cut for this movie after First Contact. I was wrong. It just looks like the budget was cut.
Oh, no.
I decided to look it up, and First Contact had a budget of $45 million mm-hmm. in 1996. Mm-hmm. For some perspective on that, a movie like Aquaman gets $165 million.
Okay.
BVS and Captain America Civil War each got $250.
Okay.
Just for some perspective, the newer Star Wars movies are about $200. They vary a little bit, but they're about $200. Okay, so that's modern day, of course, but this was 1996. Insurrection got $58 million 2 years later.
Oh, okay.
Which is, percentage-wise, a pretty decent bump.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's crazy. And then even crazier is Nemesis got 60.
Oh, geez.
You know, so it got even
much better for that.
So it's just kind of interesting.
You could have hired a better director.
Well, I will say,
we'll get to that.
We'll get to Nemesis. I do think Nemesis looks more expensive than Insurrection does.
Yeah. So, I mean, we can talk about it when we get deep into Insurrection, but I really like the way they use the budget. I think the cinematography is good. I think the effects are good. I think the setting was great. There's just a lot to enjoy, and it was visually very appealing. The space battles, actually rewatching this afternoon, the space battles were much more exciting than I remember.
Yeah, that's fair. As far as the movies go, it probably has the better space battle in it because,
yeah.
I mean, let's face it, the Generations is a couple of torpedoes exchanged between the Enterprise and a bird of prey. First Contact, you have the cool Borg scene, but it's very quick.
Yeah.
You don't get to see a whole lot of it. And then Nemesis does have the really cool ramming scene that I really love. Actually, maybe Nemesis has the best space battles.
For sure.
When we rewatch that. But yeah, so let's start with something. So on Twitter, I decided to poll everybody. So I was curious, because this movie, to my knowledge, is a little polarizing for Star Trek fans, for movie fans. And so Twitter lets you do four possible answers on a poll. That's your cap. And so I had asked, where do you think Insurrection ranks among the four TNG films? And we got zero first place. So nobody thinks it's the best. But what's interesting after that is how even second, third, and fourth are.
Right.
So second place is 37%.
I was one of those votes.
Okay. Fourth place is 33%.
That was me.
Okay. And then third place is 30%. So they're all really close together after that first place, 0%. And I just thought that was really interesting that I'm assuming everybody is saying that First Contact is the best of the four.
Yeah.
I don't want to speak for everybody who voted, but...
I mean, you can at this point.
But it's my podcast, Dan.
Get your own podcast.
So,
your own podcast, you generations-loving weirdo.
God.
So, Ray, you were saying that you think this is the third best of the four.
I guess, yeah. I didn't really like it.
You didn't really like Insurrection?
Correct.
And Zach, you're on the other side of that. You think it's the second best.
I absolutely love it. And to be so, like, First Contact is kind of a go-to feel-good movie for me. I've seen it a lot. Rewatching it for last week was fun, but, you know, I've seen it a lot.
Yeah.
Watching Insurrection for me this time, I was like, oh, God, why don't I watch this movie more often?
Yeah, First Contact is a much easier movie to watch, I think, than most of the Star Trek films. Like, when people tell me I've never watched Star Trek, where should I start? I actually tell them that First Contact's a pretty good entry point.
Yeah.
If you don't like First Contact as a science fiction film on its own,
mm-hmm.
Star Trek's probably not for you.
Yeah.
If you haven't already been watching Star Trek, that is. Now, of course, there's always exceptions. Some people didn't like that Picard became the action hero,
sure.
Which he kind of extends in Insurrection, so at least there's some consistency.
Right.
It kind of builds through the first three movies here. So,
and I think that's something he always wanted in the show.
Yeah.
To be honest, like something he said in behind-the-scenes features that he wanted from the show was more action, and he wanted to hook up with more women. And like he would joke with the writers constantly, from what I understand, about, or at least fairly regularly, about like, hey, the captain needs someone to fuck, basically. And, I mean, hey, so First Contact, there's no sexual scenes necessarily. There's more sexual tension in this one. But, like, he had, like, a romantic, platonic sort of friendship thing happening with, in First Contact. And in this movie, he's absolutely got pretty steamy.
Yeah, he does.
Love person.
With Donna Murphy.
Love person.
Love person. I was like, well, I almost said conquest, but that seems like more of a Kirk thing. And it just came out person. So, you know, here we are.
Yeah. Okay, so what I find really interesting about Insurrection is all of the little things that they lay in the first act or so of the movie that all come back later. Tiny, tiny things, like the hummingbird that you see when, you know, Picard first goes down and apologizes for their intrusion,
mm-hmm.
for example. All the face stretching,
mm-hmm.
you know, that happens earlier on. When they use those pulses to make Data reset his shield harmonics.
Right.
Right. You know, all these things come back later in pretty pivotal scenes.
Mm-hmm. Well, you think even, like, the crew's demeanor shifting early on in the film, like, you think, oh, we're just seeing them let loose and have fun, but, like, that comes back and is actually kind of an integral piece to this plot.
Yes. So, Ray, you're kind of quiet. I know this isn't your favorite thing in the world.
No, I just don't have much to say about it. It's not that it's not enjoyable. It was an enjoyable film to watch. The reason why it's not my favorite is because nothing is memorable from it. I watched it the first time, and I didn't remember anything about it. I watched it this time, and it's really hard for me to recall things. Like, it's just not very remarkable. And at least Generations... I think Generations is a worse movie. But I can remember more from it, so personally, I enjoy it a bit better.
That's interesting. I think the things that stand out to me in Insurrection are probably not the things that we're supposed to.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I remember the cheesy stuff, like, you know, the joystick that comes up in the middle of the bridge, mm-hmm. so Riker mm-hmm. can control it.
You constantly reference Riker and Troy's relationship.
Yeah.
Specifically from this film. Like,
I liked it.
Yeah.
It was fun.
It's really good. Like, I'm not upset about how this film went down. Like, I just don't remember very much. You quote it.
I do.
A lot. And I don't remember what you're doing. I I always assume that's my standard go-to is that if you're quoting something, it's probably either Star Trek or Clue. And if I can't figure it out, then maybe you watch something new for once. I don't know.
Oh, wow. Cheerful.
It's pretty honest, though, and that's why you know it.
That's why it hurts, because it's true.
So the scene, the Riker Troy scene, is actually, it's one of my favorite next-gen scenes.
The bathtub scene or like the shoulder rubbing scene?
Neither.
Oh, okay.
Neither.
Okay.
It's when he visits her in her quarters.
Oh, yeah.
And
yes.
He, you know, he's like, I think I need some counseling. She goes, well, there's a first time for everything. And he lays down on her lap, you know. And it's just really cute. And then he kisses her and she starts laughing and says, yuck, you know.
Yeah. I kiss you, you say yuck.
And she closes the door in his face. It feels like the most genuine interaction they've ever had on screen.
Yeah.
And I loved every minute of it.
To be honest, a lot of their scenes together felt very genuine. Like, I liked when she first comes in and she's flirting with him and she's like, kind of like, I don't know if she was like rubbing his shoulder or whatever, but like, you know, he's like, oh, like, what are you doing? Like, you haven't done that in a while. And like, I just, in that moment, because, you know, you think back to like season one even, and here are two very stilted, underdeveloped characters at this point. And now, like, you're getting the sense that there's been this, like, very genuine, like, heartfelt backstory. And, I don't know, like, I believed in that moment that they were a real couple. I believed that they really cared about each other. It was cool to see that. I do like how the movies develop their relationship and each of them as characters. Not a fan of Riker shaving.
No.
Smooth as an android's bottom, eh, Data?
Oh, God. Yeah. Why would you go back? Yeah, why would you shave?
I think, I mean...
In that bathtub scene, why? I mean, it was funny. It was amusing, but why?
I think it's just to make him look younger because everybody else is supposed to be, you know, feeling younger and stuff like that, right?
Sure.
That's what it's really supposed to be. Because in Nemesis, you can kind of see his age a little bit.
Yeah.
Jonathan Frakes. And maybe that's on purpose because he's becoming captain and he's getting married and they wanted him to look a little more seasoned, you know, kind of like what they did with Chakotay early on in Voyager and then got rid of later on the show.
Right.
But... Yeah, I just felt like it was tied in with the whole kind of everyone's feeling rejuvenated down on the planet type thing.
See, my issue with that is Riker and Troy, I guess, their behavior didn't seem to me like it was sparked by the planet. It just seemed like something they've been wanting to do for so long. As actors, like, they've been wanting to flirt finally, and as characters, those two characters have wanted to just bet each other already. And it makes me upset that this is the first time in their whole canon that they've gotten to, minus their canon before the show started.
Right,
like,
right.
Good God, why didn't they hook these people up sooner? Because they look like they just belong together.
I blame moonlighting. I mean, the whole model with, like, television in the 90s is, like, you have to have these elaborate will they, won't they, because as soon as they do, then there's the loss of magic. Like, moonlighting is the famous example because when Bruce Willis and... her name escapes me.
Sybil Shepherd.
Yeah. When they got together, that show went downhill. And so there is this, like, perceived, like, curse on shows. I mean, so...
It's a huge difference, though, in this case. Because
there
are seven main characters on the show.
For sure.
If you count Wesley.
Yes.
But in Moonlighting, it was those two characters.
Wesley. Yeah. No, you're right. That's a fair comparison.
But TNG was made for syndication, incredibly episodic.
Right. There couldn't be a whole lot of continuity.
So there wasn't a lot of relationship growth. The characters that really got to grow were Data and Wesley.
Mm-hmm.
And those... That was it, really.
You couldn't deny Wesley's growth. Like, he was literally
growing up in front of our eyes.
What are you going to do? At some point, the kid's got to go for the academy, right?
Like, but also, to your point, like, you think about The Office, like, and there are a lot of people, myself included, who feel like once Jim and Pam get together, the show kind of got boring. So, but regardless, I agree with you. It did seem like something... wanted to do.
That's also because in The Office, they didn't develop the other characters.
Yeah, no, that's
you
also
you know, if they would have focused just a little bit more on Oscar or Meredith or Kevin or Angela at the time, like, it could have been really fun. Like,
touche. I see that point. That's a good point.
They focused on Michael, Jim, and Pam so long that the show, of course, was going to be pointless after.
Once they were not
around. Yeah. No, TNG did kind of tease a Troy Worf thing.
Yeah.
Especially at the end of the show.
Uh-huh.
That's so funny since they moved Worf to DS9. Mm-hmm. Terry Farrell and Marina Sirtis are, like, best friends in real life. And they kind of look alike, you know. Not physical bone structure, but, you know, they're white women with brown hair. And both aliens on the show. And
Worf has a type.
Worf has a type. But yeah, they kind of just, when they decided Worf was going to go to DS9, they kind of wrote that off in the movies.
Yeah.
But I think that's why they have that exchange between Riker and Worf in Insurrection, you know, mm-hmm. where he mentions that, you know, their feelings for each other have never really changed. This just let them out like for a stroll, you know, yeah. or whatever the... Or fresh air. Let them out for some fresh air.
Yeah.
I liked that comment.
Yeah.
Now, just in case there's anybody listening out there who is very specific and technical about what happens in canon and Trek, being in the Briar Patch means you're affected by that radiation. And mm-hmm. it's the planet's rings that are special. But I don't even know if that's really true. I think the Sona were just lying to screw over the Baku. So
let's talk more about that.
Yeah.
Like... Yeah, absolutely. Because you said yourself, and I liked this, it didn't seem like the planet was affecting them. It seemed like they were just acting on what they always wanted to.
There are a few characters that seemed like they were slightly more affected than others. But
sure.
even Picard just seemed like he was more energetic. The dancing yeah. is not uncharacteristic for him. And
it's him, very infrequent, but not uncharacteristic.
Him being attracted to a woman who is knowledgeable and confident and outgoing and takes a leadership role is yeah. also not uncharacteristic. No, so
something Picard and I have in common.
It kind of just feels like this planet lets them be themselves instead of mm-hmm. who they are for the Federation.
Yeah, and that's a really good symbol of what this movie's about, because they have to break rank from the Federation, and they get to be themselves in a way that they never were before as a result of everything that goes down.
Yeah, I mean, to a small extent, this is TNG's voyage home.
Yeah.
Right? Where they're breaking all the rules, doing what they think is the right thing to do, out of uniform most of the time.
TNG uncut.
There's just no whales in this one. No. But... I mean, I like that. I like, because one of the big critiques of TNG is how sterile it is and mm-hmm. how, you know, everyone's just the most perfect officer ever, flawless uh-huh. people thing.
But so warm and real.
Insurrection makes them feel more real. These people are risking their careers to do what they feel is right, to support their friends, to yeah. support, you know, people that they've now been with for a decade, mm-hmm. you know?
One of the things I love most about this film, which is why I think maybe a lot of people don't like it, and I wouldn't begrudge anyone disliking it for these reasons, is that this film is significantly better in context. Not just with TNG, but with Deep Space Nine. So, for TNG, you talk about how Picard is lighter and dancing and feeling happy, more happy and carefree. But it's like, let's think about it. Like, the last movie, Picard just faced some really heavy demons and basically had some major therapy breakthroughs. So, of course, he's feeling great. More apt to dance. And if you, you know, if you ignore the previous movies, like, that's a thing. Also, there's a ton of references to Deep Space Nine that if you're not looking for them, you're not going to catch them.
He flat out says that the Federation has been dealing with the Dominion yes. War and the Cardassians.
But, so. Like, also, like, Ketracel White, Riker makes a reference to that, like, talking about how, like, you know, that's a natural resource there. Mm-hmm. There is that solar ship, which isn't a direct reference to Deep Space Nine, but there are solar ships that you see early on in Deep Space Nine. The context of... And I feel like one of the critiques of this movie could easily be, like, you know, why is the Federation acting this way? Where it's like, well, Deep Space Nine put the Federation at a disadvantage and caused the entire Federation to question its values in itself. And that's one of the things I love most about that show. And this particular movie definitely exhibits that in the fact that you've got this high-ranking Federation officer who's making some very un-Federation-like decisions. The Trail of Tears, which we can talk more about later, but, like, all of these parallels to our own history and our not so proud moments of our history. One of my favorite things about this.
It doesn't matter what context. If you have a situation that can be made parallel to negative things in history, you probably should re-evaluate your situation. The forced mm-hmm. relocation of a people never turns out well.
No. Picard makes that point, and I love that speech. How many people does it take to make it not okay?
Well, like, just the other day, this guy on Twitter was talking about Comics Gate, and he flat out said, well, why can't there be separate comics for women that are still equal? And I was like, you literally just said the phrase separate but equal. Oh, my God. That's not equal. Like, no. So it just... people think they have good intentions, but mm-hmm. it clearly gets out of hand. And I think maybe I dislike this movie because of the Sona. Because they're, like, some of the least interesting part, but it's the movie is named after them and their whole situation. But I can appreciate that he flat out says that the Federation is old and stale, and they have these old people sticking to these things that clearly aren't working, these protocols that aren't working, and they need to change things up. So, you know, I can appreciate when the good guys get called out on bad things that they're doing or in bad ways, and there's more efficient ways out there to get things accomplished.
Mm-hmm. I think what a lot of people forget, because this movie is not as exciting as First Contact, it's probably not even as exciting as Nemesis, really.
Yeah.
It is the most Trek of the four films because of what it focuses on, right? It focuses on ethical, moral dilemmas and how to handle those situations. And that's what Star Trek has always done.
Yeah.
Right? From its very roots, is tackle racism, sexism, classism, all these different types of things, to tackle all of that.
All the isms.
There's been a subset in Trek fandom, I've noticed in recent weeks even, the very vocal subset of Trek fandom, that is all about, like, well, since when was Trek all about social justice warriors? And I'm like, From the beginning, pay attention. Have you been watching the same show?
Yeah, that's always what it's been. And Insurrection, I think, does that more so than maybe any of the films.
I agree. That's part of what I love about it.
Which I think is really important. And Picard's speech to the Admiral is a big deal.
Yeah.
Right? It's a point that I've tried to make to people on similar issues before. And of course, Patrick Stewart's going to say it better than I'm ever going to say it. But, you know, the message is pretty clear, right? At what point is it okay?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, bringing up that the Federation is in a difficult position, again, is a point into itself, that just because you're backed into a corner doesn't mean that's when you abandon your ideals either.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, the Federation, they've gone up against the Dominion, the Cardassians, the Borg. They're having a rough time. Soon the Romulans are going to try and attack, right? Yeah. Like, it's rough. But that doesn't mean that's when you are supposed to abandon who you are and what everything was founded on. That's why Section 31 is a very controversial area of Trek mythos.
Yeah.
Because it isn't Federation ideals.
It's when you show up on November 6th and you vote these Federation higher-ups out.
Yes.
You try new things.
Get the fresh blood in there.
Cough, cough, hint, hint.
Anyway.
Hey, Trek and politics go hand in hand.
Of course they do. Of course they do.
And if that offends you, then find another podcast. Sorry, Derek. That's probably how you want me to tell your listeners.
Well, shut up. I guess we kind of got off on a pretty huge tangent here, so let's bring things back.
Well, we can talk about the Baku and the Sona. Like, I think the twist that they're the exact same is incredibly good.
Yeah.
I think it's a really fun twist. That's something that you see in movies now all the time, and it's not handled nearly as well. Mm-hmm. And to think, like, the movie, I think, missed its mark, the fact that the Sona went through hell physically and emotionally trying to keep themselves alive just to get back to their planet and take it over. And they don't even touch on that. Like, these people could have been incredibly tormented characters, but instead they're all very one note. And that's because you also have to focus on seven other characters as well as the Baku themselves. Like, the movie just wasn't long enough. If it was, like, two movies instead, maybe they would have gotten to that eventually.
Sure.
But I just found the whole Sona story incredibly interesting, but one-noted.
Well, that's the thing. You really only get to know two Sona, really, right, in the entire movie. And it's kind of interesting because on one hand, you look at Insurrection, you say, wow, it's kind of risky for them to make up a brand new alien as their villain for the movie, right? Mm-hmm. Because Trek doesn't usually do that. That's why it's the Klingons a lot of the time, you know, in...
No.
You know, it's... I mean, look, the Klingons are the bad guys in three. They're a bad guy also in five. 6 and 7. You know?
Yeah.
They kind of show up in Into Darkness.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. And so, like, they're bad guys a lot of the time. And, you know, I guess you have God in 5, too.
God, I mean, you know. No, never mind. I'm not going to make that joke.
But then when you find out that they did this because they are really the Baku, then it becomes really interesting. It is a cool twist. It is really interesting. I like that a lot. The problem, though, that I kind of have with it is they are very technologically advanced.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They've got all these battleships with illegal, highly advanced weaponry. You know, they clearly know what they're doing with all of this technology. And so it begs the question, is this the old Baku tech that they abandoned on the planet? Or did they steal this technology or develop it themselves after they left? You know, because they conquered those other species when, you know, Troy and Riker are in the library.
Yeah.
You know, is that their technology? Do they already have that technology in order to conquer those species? Right? It opens up a lot of interesting questions.
Correct.
I will say, though, that's something I really like about these people, is that regardless of where it came from or how they acquired this technology, the fact that they have chosen to reject that makes them fairly unique.
It does, especially because they're only rejecting it, you know, on their day-to-day lives. Clearly the tech is around somewhere, or else they wouldn't have been able to find out what was wrong with Data.
Right.
You know, just, you know, being intelligent is not enough. You have to have something to record that.
These are the Amish of the future.
more Mennonite, really, right? Because they have the technology, and they would use it when necessary, but they do everything they can to keep that on the back and not have that influence their daily lives. And that's a really difficult thing to do. I mean, from my perspective, I'm a tech junkie. It's a part of why I'm a sci-fi fan. I want all of this. I want holodecks, you know, and comm badges and warp drive. I want all of that stuff. So the idea of achieving it and then putting it back in the box just seems insurmountable.
I can see it. I've thought many times about walking away. The idea of a farmhouse or a cabin house or a beach house has been pretty appealing at times, but I also have a very public persona, and that comes with more backlash than praise some days. So,
yeah.
You know, a different perspective. I could walk away from it for a little while. You know, having that escape would be pretty amazing at times. Now, if it also came with eternal youth, like, well, hello. Yeah.
Well, there's that, right? Because then if you have endless decades to learn amazing skills that you would take a lifetime to learn.
But not swimming, apparently.
But not swimming. Well, she never got around to it.
It's a survival skill. Like, learn how to swim.
Not if all of your needs are being taken care of and you don't have to, like, get in the water.
I mean, that's the
I'm
thing.
I'm going to expand my mind.
I get it. There's things I don't know how to do. I've never, you know, gone bungee jumping or skydiving or anything like that.
There's musical instruments I don't know how to play.
Age isn't going to kill her, but there are other things that could potentially kill her. Just learn how to swim.
Like, I mean, clearly it wasn't something that was considered high priority for their people.
No, it was written in there for an a cute little exchange. That's why.
Yeah.
Like,
because Data is a flotation device?
That was great. That was, like, great. That was
Data
adorable.
Data was great in this movie. Data's interaction with that kid.
Yes.
Fantastic.
Yes.
Oh, at the end when he has to leave. Bye.
His struggle to not have that kid be scared of him was just very compassionate.
Yeah.
It was endearing to watch. It was genuine. And, like, even my least favorite moments of Trek, I can appreciate how amazing Brent Spiner was. Like,
so true.
Out of all the aliens that they have, they've only ever had two actors that created a whole new gait and development of speech, and, you know, everything that they did was this new creature, and that's Brent Spiner and Doug Jones, and that's it. Like, nobody else has ever done that. So
I mean, I want to give some credit to Leonard Nimoy
was the first to create the whole Vulcan perspective, but he still walked like a human. He still...
It was not a normal Leonard Nimoy walk and movement, though. It was very rigid and stoic and collected. And
there was nuance. I will give you that.
I'm not saying that it was bad. I'm saying
No, I know.
You know, just,
I think he started it, and then you had Data, and now you have Saru. Mm-hmm. And DS9 and Voyager didn't really have that much.
No,
I guess. I mean, you there was argue the potential for Odo.
There was.
Odo's not really that way. I mean,
well, and like, the point of Odo is to be as inoffensive and as like a morphic, a everything. Like he is like his distinguishment is to be without feature or memory. You know, in a sense. Yeah. So,
I was really just saying, like, giving Brent Spiner as much credit as possible, because he was wonderful in this film.
He really was, and I mean, there's a level of, like, bittersweet aspect to this, as when you figure in with context. Spoilers, next week, we are going to discuss the end of Data's journey, and you see these tender moments with him and this child, and this compassion, and this empathy, after getting his emotion chip, and if you've watched all these movies before, you know what's coming. Like, Data's journey is about to end. And so, seeing him, like, the growth that his character's made since Encounter at Farpoint is really cool.
And he's not used to people being afraid of him. He's used to people wanting to exploit him.
Yes.
Steal him.
Yes.
Take him apart. Mm-hmm. Right? That he's used to. He's come to terms with that.
Right.
But he's not used to people, especially children, because the Enterprise is filled with kids.
Uh-huh.
Especially the Enterprise D. I guess we don't know as much for the E. But he's not used to kids being afraid of him.
Well, and think about, again, context. First contact, Data experienced fear for, as far as we know, the first time in such an intense fashion. And so he understands...
Generations, when he can't say Geordi, is a pretty pivotal moment.
It's a pivotal moment, for sure. But, like, they discuss directly his experience with fear in First Contact. So, again, Generations, First Contact, he's had this experience with fear. Now he meets this kid who's afraid of him, and he knows what that feels like to be on the receiving end.
Yeah.
And so there's this empathy play here that is huge for humanity and for Data's character as he, you know, strives to become more human.
Absolutely. And he has a cool arc in this. I love when Picard and Worf go to get him.
Yeah.
I love the singing scene. I think it's great.
It's fun. This movie's a lot of fun, and that scene was fun.
I love it.
I actually think that Worf got the short end of the stick in this one.
In the movie, like, you mean? Yeah.
Doesn't he always? He's always getting shut down.
Yeah. Like, they use him simply to prove that somebody is strong, so he always is getting his ass kicked for no reason. And he never actually gets to be the big badass action hero, even though he should be.
Yeah.
But that role usually goes to Riker.
That's why when Dorn was talking about a Worf show, I'm like, yes, this is Worf's moment to shine. Well, I want that.
That's because Worf is so much better of a character on Deep Space Nine.
Yes.
Because he's given so many more opportunities to do things on a serialized show where he can grow as a character and you learn more about who he is in the Klingon culture.
But his majority storyline in this film is a pimple on his face and long hair, and that sucks. Like, Worf is better than that.
He's better. He deserved better than what TNG gave him. Yes. Go watch Deep Space Nine if you haven't.
But going back to the scene, though.
Yes,
the singing
please,
scene.
Let's talk
so about it. I never noticed this before until this last watch, but British Tar is basically about Picard in this movie. The what they sing.
I need
to
watch it.
So, because the lines are... Okay, I'm not going to sing it.
Come on, Derek.
Sing.
Stop it. So, it's a British Tar is a soaring soul, as free as a mountain bird. His energetic fist should be ready to resist a dictatorial word. And it goes on, right? So, the whole point is that he is this loving, caring, free soul...
Yeah.
Who's normally strapped down by duty, but he won't follow orders blindly either, and he will stand up against tyranny, is basically what it's saying.
I love that. And right? I'm so enamored with the fun of that scene that I never pay attention to the lyrics. That's cool. That adds a layer. That's cool.
Well, because, I mean, you know, growing up, you watch this on VHS on a small TV, reading the words on the screen. It was so secondary because it was so small. But now, on Blu-ray, on my big TV, I can see it. Uh-huh. And I started reading the lyrics. I'm like, wait a minute. And so I looked it up just to be sure. And I just thought that was super cool. That was a nice... I don't know. I'm sure it was intentional.
Oh, it had to have been. Yeah.
Right?
I like that.
So I love that scene. I thought it looked really good, too. You don't get to see a lot of shuttle-on-shuttle, in-atmosphere maneuvers on Star Trek very often. And so this was a cool bit to see with, you know, a couple of new craft, really.
Yeah.
And some neat stuff going on there.
I can also appreciate the fact that it was a song that brought him out of this kind of defense stasis that he was in to a certain degree, because
coming out of his cage and doing just fine.
Oh, God.
Well, to that point, we'll talk about this again next week because, again,
I killed Rachel just now. Sorry,
guys. With the killers.
Yeah. Oh, God.
Anyway.
I'll be here all week.
But next week when we talk about Nemesis, music plays another factor in Data's life, as we'll talk about, right?
That's a very human situation. You know, they use music to jog a lot of people's memories.
Like, yeah.
Psychologists, doctors, all kinds of scientists have they use us to trigger our emotions. And this entire run of TNG, Data has tried to understand what it's like to be human because he just can't fathom it. That was a very human moment.
Well, and his musical works have always played a big factor in Star Trek because he's always doing the symphonies and the orchestra stuff and things like that. And he always shrugs off compliments by simply saying that, of course, he plays it perfectly. And Picard always tries to point out that he's making conscious decisions on his own in how he is taking inspiration from, you know, prior artists, right? Yeah. And musicians, human and alien, you know, musicians, their styles, and he's blending styles that have never been blended before, right? Yeah. This is an extension of that, right? This is as part of his, quote, soul, so to speak, whatever his being is, whatever you want to call that. Music, art, his artwork is a massive part of that.
I was told a long time ago that because the way our brains work, while music has the possibility to be infinite, humans don't have the ability to create that. We have certain sounds in our head that we cannot get rid of. And so our music will always just kind of transform old things that we've already heard. That the next time we hear something new in music will be if we ever meet new life. And I think that's really kind of very reflective on Data, that he's able to create new stuff.
Yeah.
There's YouTube videos that dissect pop music and the same threads you hear throughout.
Pachelbel's canon.
Right, exactly. Like, YouTube, Pachelbel's canon, and then prepare to have your mind blown if you haven't already.
Because I love that video.
Yeah. And you could look at it very cynically and be like, oh, you know, people are unoriginal, they're always copying. But I think it's really beautiful that there are certain sounds that resonate so profoundly with the human brain that they keep appearing.
You can choose to be negative and be depressed that you'll never hear anything new, or you can revel in the fact that people are able to repackage some beautiful creations over and over again into new things. So,
and it's more than just music. I mean, you think about like mythology. Like, we've been telling the same basic hero story forever. And that doesn't make it any less valuable. In fact, with each new generation and reiteration of that same hero's tale, it just further cements that as a part of our existence as humans.
So there are, you know, other characters that get some interesting arcs in here. Geordi gets a little bit, which he doesn't get too often.
He doesn't have a good arc. He has some, like, good moments.
Yeah.
Well, the fact that this man got to be completely visor and contactless free was beautiful.
And for the first time in a decade.
Like, you could see that true emotion on his face. He's like, I am on the set of Trek and not reading Rainbow, and I get to see, and it's awesome.
But like, you don't have to take my word for it. Motherfuckers, you can see the tears in my eyes.
When I say arc, though, I kind of mean the character as a whole through the beginning till now, because his vision's obviously a very large part of his character, and it's used sometimes as a MacGuffin because he can just magically see the thing that they need to see.
Yeah.
But other times, you know, it's shown to, you know, be something that people take advantage of, like in Generations, you know, and this, I think, is an interesting opportunity to show that he struggled with this and now has an opportunity to be done with it, and he still knows what's right and wrong.
Yeah, right? Beautiful moment. Yeah, I agree.
It's interesting. I mean, maybe they should have done something where one of the main cast was wishy-washy on it. You know,
but he would be the one to do it. And not just wishy-washy, like, hey, let's relocate these people. But maybe in the end, maybe he should have considered staying.
Yeah.
I don't think he could ever be happy not on a starship.
And those two lines could have been all that it took. Yeah.
Right. That would have been super interesting because you think about it, like, we're all human beings and we're all constantly holding tension. Like, we are all constantly weighing our values and what's
most important
to us.
All three of us wear glasses. It would be great for all of us to wake up tomorrow and not need glasses. Like,
yeah, but I kind of like my face with glasses at this point, so I'd probably still wear them.
Fair enough.
Fine.
It's a cool moment, though.
It is. Well, and him watching the sunrise and, like, that whole moment, like, because he's such a face actor. Like, his face and his eyes are a huge part of it. He sells that scene. And also, I think it is true quintessential Trek that they filmed that scene during the sunrise instead of sunset. Because both would have been very beautiful and profound to see for the first time with eyes like a normal human. But the fact that it's a sunrise, like, definitely speaks to this hopeful optimism that Trek is known for. And that was awesome.
Absolutely. And it fuels the scene on the captain's yacht, right? Where they all show up together as a group, because that's how you're going to do it.
Yeah.
And you just know who has to stay because they're the only ones that didn't get regular clothes.
I never noticed it until you pointed it out, by the way. Because you're like, so did Geordi and Riker have to stay because they decided not to change? Mm-hmm. And my brain went, son of a bitch.
Yep.
I never noticed. That's hilarious. But yeah, that's why. I'm sure that's why.
Yep.
But I love that moment, though.
Sometimes you wake up in the morning and your outfit says everything about you for the entire day.
I love that all of them, none of them were willing to stay behind. None of them were willing to just let him go off on his own, right?
Yes.
And they all get their little line. They don't have a whole lot to say. You know, Data gets to say the cool thing, right?
He does.
Saddle up, lock and load.
He always gets to say the cool things. Like, I think it was very obvious, even in this one, like, even by now, that Data was the writer's favorite character to write for.
Oh, sure.
Like, that's why he gets the cool lines. That's why he gets the great story arc. And that's why Geordi and Worf and Crusher take a back seat and do kind of nothing.
It's sad. I forget Crusher is even in this movie, and I just watched it this afternoon. She's one of my favorite characters.
She has more to do in this than First Contact.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's true, but I still forget she's in it.
But
what was Worf's big line in this movie?
Well, I mean, Worf's got a couple of funny moments, because when you first see him in the movie, he's explaining to Picard why he's not on Deep Space Nine, and then the movie literally cuts him off so they don't have to have a reason.
Right. Right.
Because at this point, they're like, forget it. He's going to be in the movie, just deal with it.
Right.
And move on.
You couldn't do it without him, and that was just basically, like, super fan service.
Yeah, it was like, Deep Space Nine is a show, and it's happening right now. Tune in, whatever station.
They should have done that.
Oh, they should have. A scrolling text at the bottom.
With, like, just a little Cisco with the point meme, you know? Anyway.
But he had one, I'm trying to remember.
I mean, he's got the...
He talks about the gorge.
The aggressive tendencies line when he smashes the thing with the...
Yeah, that's right.
With the rifle,
like,
you know?
He totally is hair goals. I want beautiful hair like that. Like,
yeah, I mean, I hate that he was a puberty metaphor, but that hair, he was rocking it.
Like,
he should grow his hair out just permanently.
The Klingons usually have really nasty looking hair, and I just want to comb it or, like, wash it or something, but not this gentleman.
Queer eye for the Klingons. I'd watch that show.
I mean, I feel like they were trying to adjust a bit, because Worf had a little more to do in First Contact.
Uh-huh.
You know, he gets to lead one of the teams on the Borg decks. He gets to go out on the spacewalk. He has the big altercation with Picard.
Yeah.
Right? He gets a little more to do, where, like, Riker doesn't have anywhere near as much to do in First Contact.
No.
Right? And maybe that's why First Contact... Well, he directed this, too.
Yeah, I guess you're right.
Right? So maybe that's why First Contact is better, because he just didn't, as an actor, didn't have as much to worry about and could focus more on the directing, where here it was more split.
That's fair.
I mean, I think a lot.
But I love this movie almost as much as First Contact. First Contact is better.
I think, like, the script is better. It's stronger. Like, the story is just better. The writing was better. The lines were better. I just think, as a whole, things were just better done.
Yeah, I mean, the movie looks better across the board. It looks more expensive. It looks more impressive.
But it was an action movie. This is more of a moral play.
Yes, which is why I think Zach, you and me really love Insurrection because it is a long episode.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
Right.
And the average person doesn't go into a movie wanting a long episode
of TNG, yeah.
Right.
And me are like, sign me the fuck up. Average moviegoers are like, what about the Borg? Where's the action?
And that's why I've always said that, you know, of course, I will go see Star Trek movies, but it's really meant for television.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it's meant for. It's meant for long-form storytelling, where it's not a world-ending consequence every single time.
And the objectively best Star Trek films are part moral play, part action film. Like, so, like, you know, like Wrath of Khan, First Contact,
Undiscovered Country,
and then Star Trek Beyond.
Right.
Like, you've got these things that, like, combine everything that we love about Trek as fans, but also are palatable to mass audiences.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been very few, relatively speaking, very few Star Trek films that walk that line successfully. Because yeah. It belongs on TV and episodic content.
Absolutely. So, I mean, you have some other really cool moments. I like the Riker-Geordi dynamic on the Enterprise when they mm-hmm. go off on their own and have to fight the Sona.
Yeah.
I think it's really cool. It makes me want to see, you know, a Titan show with Geordi as the chief engineer.
Yeah.
You know, because I just think that would have been really cool to see the two of them together, because they're both more, you know, cowboy diplomacy than Picard, right? Yeah. They're a little bit more TOS-y in the way they do stuff.
Yeah.
Right? You know, because... You know, Geordi eject the core, and he's like, I already did that. You know? Oh, that was good. Yeah, the I just did line is just great. It's so good.
And those are two characters that you don't see interact as much. And it's like, with these, like, what, seven main characters, there are a lot of combinations that you don't see enough of, and mm-hmm. so that was cool to see that shine.
Absolutely. So I would have liked to have seen more of that type of stuff.
Yeah.
Because there's a few good scenes. You've got the warp core scene, you've got the ram scoop scene, you know.
Yeah.
Riker's got some great lines, you know, we're through running from these bastards, you yeah. know, and
right.
stuff like
it's
that.
It's like, we're not on basic television anymore, I can say bastards, and I'm gonna, because I'm the director, goddammit.
So I like that a lot.
Same, yeah.
You know, I will say that I actually like the big climax between Ruafu and Picard on the Collector.
Yeah.
I was reading an article recently that basically is claiming that that set was unfinished and all the blue was supposed to be replaced with some type of CGI background.
I'm glad it wasn't, though.
But it never was. Now, the official Paramount response is that was intentionally what it was supposed to look like. But when someone points it out and you look at it, it does kind of look like it's just blue screen.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's a coincidence or not, but I actually like that scene quite a bit.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Ruafu is still trying to convince Picard that this is the right thing to do.
Yeah.
And, you know, he beams over there assuming he's not coming back.
Yeah.
Right? He believes this is it for him.
Not the first or last time that Picard will do such a thing.
No, it's not.
I can appreciate a person who's willing to do the right thing even if it means their end, mm-hmm. you know?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that shows his conviction as a character,
yeah.
right? We know that he is willing to do whatever it takes to do the right morally ethical thing,
yeah.
even if that means he doesn't make it back. You know, that's who Picard is. And I mean, Spock does it in The Wrath of Khan.
Yeah.
You know, other characters do it in other stuff. You know,
other characters do another stuff.
Well, I mean, Data does it.
You're right.
You know, Data does it in Nemesis, you know.
Yeah. Tune in next week.
Right? And, I mean, like it or not like it, in Into Darkness, Kirk does it.
He does.
I want to be here when you guys talk about Into Darkness, because I'm the only person who actually likes
well,
it.
Well, yeah, we're doing it next week.
Or Into Darkness?
Oh, Into Darkness.
Yeah.
Nemesis. Sorry.
Yeah.
Into Darkness is down the road.
I don't want to be here for that.
but my point is, characters have done that to show that they will do whatever it takes to fulfill who they've been.
Yeah.
Right? And that's who Picard is. That's mm-hmm. who he's always been. That's who he will always kind of be at the core.
Yeah.
Right? And I like that, you know? what's the line? He goes, are you really going to risk igniting the gas? And Rafa kind of pauses. He goes, all right. Well, I am. Just like shoots
yeah.
it. Because he thinks he's going to die anyway. So if that's how it happens,
yeah.
you know, then all right. Right?
I love that. Yeah.
So I think that's a cool moment. It also gives a really great sweeping shot of the Enterprise swooping down
yeah.
over the exploding collector is a really nice shot.
Yeah. I like this Cardassian-esque Enterprise.
It looks good.
It really does.
Yeah.
It's one of the... I don't own it as a model, but if I ever found it for a decent price, I would buy it.
It's good to know. Ray, any thoughts?
No, I told you before, like, I don't really pay attention to the ships. Sorry.
Like, we could try and force her to have an opinion about ships, and
it'll
never happen.
But, like, the climactic battle between Picard and Ruafu or anything.
Like I told you.
Okay.
I said that I can appreciate somebody who goes to their end just to make sure the right thing happens. And, you know, that's not easy. We see... our leaders constantly take the easy route or, you know, stand up for people just because they were paid by them, and it's disheartening. So at least the fictional characters still stand up for the little guy or what's right. And
yeah,
so I can appreciate that. No matter how much the Sona are just underutilized or underdeveloped or just, you know, one notes, at least Picard makes it all worthwhile.
And I like what you said too, which as a quick plug for the Picard show, like that is why I feel like the Picard show is so important, and I'm glad that it's coming back, because he is exactly the type of leader and hero that that we need right now.
So. And it's very obvious why every cast member from TNG has said, like, yeah, you want me? I'm there tomorrow. Oh, like, yeah. I'm there yesterday. Let's do this.
Which, and I'll mention this next week, but like, I think in hindsight, my main problem with Nemesis is that that was the end for that cast. And I want the Picard show to be the Picard show without, like, being overburdened with all these guest stars. However, if we got a proper, like, TNG reunion, like, maybe in, like, season two of the Picard show, and it, I don't know. Or if just the finale of the Picard show is just, like, a two-hour movie that brings everyone back together again, like, I'm not going to be mad about it.
They meet on a yearly basis anyway, right? Like, they get together a lot. Yeah. They're friends. Why wouldn't it be practical for them to stay friends in the show universe as well? In Trek universe, why couldn't they all get together for like a every 5 year dinner kind of thing?
Yeah,
like
they get together for a dinner and then it turns into an adventure. I mean, I don't know.
They could easily do something like that. It could be the anniversary of when Voyager returned home.
Yeah.
Right? You could have Kate Mulgrew as, you know, an admiral giving a speech or something like that.
Because anybody on all those three shows could easily show up.
Pretty much. There's like only a couple of exceptions.
And sadly, one of them is Data.
Yeah, well, Data canon resolved that problem.
They did.
What about the whole aging thing?
Well, you can de-age people now.
That's so expensive for a TV's budget to just throw that at de-aging.
It's right, but Star Trek CBS, like, they're making money right now.
It depends what the Picard show becomes. Yes. If it is really a character-driven show about an older, 30-year-older Picard, maybe space battles aren't a thing, and maybe you can spend the budget then on that type of special effect rather than spaceships.
Yeah.
You know, part of why Discovery was so expensive was because they built, you know, they built the Discovery bridge, and it's basically
multiple times.
And like in the Kelvin films, it's built on a gimbal. It actually moves.
Yeah.
You know, which they have never done before. That's incredibly
usually the actors all just have to like wobble around in sync.
No, they jump forward. Yeah. Like
always. Yeah.
They always dive forward.
Because they're not wearing any seatbelts.
Yeah. Until next movie.
Clearly.
Those damn inertial dampeners always go offline.
Yeah. Or no, not next movie. That was six, wasn't it?
What?
The seatbelts? Which movie was that?
What do you mean?
On the bridge of the Enterprise. They introduced seatbelts.
Did they ever do that?
Yeah, it was like it was one of the movies, wasn't it? They're seatbelts.
The Franklin has seatbelts in Beyond.
Maybe that's what I'm thinking.
That's so great.
but I don't think the Enterprise ever had seatbelts.
Because like my dad, like he's gotten more into sci-fi over the last few years, but like when I was a kid, he never really got it. And like I would watch Star Trek and he'd be like, why don't they have seatbelts? And I'm like, Dad, you just don't get it. But I mean, he asked a good question.
Now, the movie poster for, was it 5? Had like a chair with seatbelts on it. And it said, why are there seatbelts coming to a theater or something like that near you or whatever. I think that's what it was. But it was super silly. Let me say it. But anyway, moving on. So, all right. We're coming up near the hour mark. What else should we discuss for Insurrection? What have we missed?
I actually can't think of anything. Like
anything else?
Did you guys know Donna Murphy also played Mother Gothel?
There you go.
I did not know that. But I mean, I agree with Picard. Like, older women.
I do have one gripe for this movie that's like a legitimate gripe. And that's the whole slowing down of time thing.
Mm.
What I don't like about it is twofold. One, somehow he's able to learn it like the second time that he tries it, which bothers me a little bit. And then on top of that, it seems to be unclear as to the range of effect for this, right? So when they're on the bench and she's teaching him how to do it, the hummingbird seems maybe 20, 30 feet away, right? And it's slowing down. You can see the wings because it's a callback to when you see the hummingbird earlier in the movie.
Yeah, yeah.
But later in the cave, he's able to slow down everything around him in the cave, but not his crewmates outside digging into the cave. Or when they enter the cave to go rescue them.
So I never thought it was like some sort of magical power that they had. Both times watching the film, I just assumed it was perception. Like, we all have those big moments in our life that we replay over and over again that last forever. And maybe they're traumatic.
Anxiety.
Maybe they're traumatic. Maybe they're, you know, boring. Maybe they're incredibly romantic. But we all just have these moments that kind of slow and some that speed up. So I honestly just thought it was perception, that we were supposed to perceive that he was just at this calm state of this moment lasting a really long time. Now I have to watch it again and assume it's a magic power, and I don't know how to handle that information.
Like, it seemed to be like an ability of some kind that they learned.
That's very not Trek to have magic.
Well, it wouldn't be magic.
That is magic. That is straight up magic, because they don't explain, and none of the other Baku seem to have this ability. So
we don't know. He didn't go on late night strolls with anybody else.
She's a witch.
She's a witch. Okay.
She's a witch.
Look, some Star Trek, you know, species have some pretty amazing abilities. Species 8472 has some crazy abilities. We already know that the Betazoids have very strong mental abilities. Mm-hmm. You know, there are other telepathic species. The Vulcans have some abilities that are unique too that you don't see very often, right?
Yeah.
It's just, for me, it's kind of like the MacGuffin in the film that is just, or not, maybe not, MacGuffin's the wrong word. Like,
yeah, it doesn't move the plot along.
Was it Chekhov's gun? Is that what it is? It's a plot device, right? That's basically, it's something that's thrown in earlier in the film that's going to basically save the day at the end.
Oh, Deus Ex Machina.
That's it. Thank you.
Yeah, there we go.
Right, like, that's basically what it is, right? She shows him a hummingbird slow down, and then later he's able to save her life, essentially.
Yeah.
With the same ability, right?
Yeah.
And it is so out of left field for Star Trek to have something like that, that it feels disjointed from the rest of the movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's my only gripe with the film. I don't know, either of you have a gripe?
They're so afraid to kill off side characters.
Afraid to kill anybody.
Like, if she would have died, it would have made for a very... Well, yeah, like, if you're a new crew member in what...
The Trill Woman didn't
movie
die.
Eight? She's like, fine. Did she get a name, though?
I mean, I'm sure she has a name.
I don't remember. Like, nobody called out her name.
I'm sure she has a name.
But poor Neil McDonough.
Well, I mean, he was just too pretty to live.
He was too pretty to live.
He has very nice eyes, even now. But yeah, like, they're just so afraid to kill off side characters for emotion. And honestly, her death would have driven the plot even further. It would have shown just how serious and how dangerous the Sona are.
But then she'd be another refrigerator woman for the sake of
Picard's absolutely. I'm not saying that it's the best thing.
I
agree with you.
I'm glad that they didn't kill her off, simply because
I just meant Trek as a whole. Yeah, like, it has a problem with.
They could have killed more people.
No, I mean, you're right, though.
You can't even kill Michelle Yao. You have to bring back the alternate version of her. But I mean, to be fair, like, I was disappointed that they didn't, you know, use her more, and now they're going to. So I'm not mad, but still,
they kill off faceless, nameless characters in the background for the sake of moving the plot along, but they don't
kill off legacy.
But they don't kill off characters that can actually affect the plot.
I mean, they killing off Tasha Yar was a pretty big deal in 1987.
She left the show,
and then Matt came back multiple times.
Yeah.
killing off Jadzia was a very big deal.
God, yeah.
And again, she left the show, but you're in the final season. You didn't have to kill her,
and now she's married to Spock's son.
So, like, that's again, weird. These are still main characters of the show, like. I guess I could draw a nice comparison to Marshall's dad.
Okay.
You know?
Voyager then did a little bit of that.
Okay.
Voyager did.
Yeah.
And I know you haven't really watched a lot of Voyager.
I haven't. I've seen so little compared to you guys.
No, but she leaves dramatically and then comes back for an episode that was
the worst thing ever. The books fixed her. Terrible. So
did they? Okay, yeah, good.
I actually figured with her, like, the species young age, killing her off would be a really easy out, and they choose not to do it, and that's weird.
I know that
there's story stuff that goes with it, but it just seems like, to me as a writer, like, oh, already their species only lives to 7, let's kill her.
Well, so they find, basically, and this is off topic, of course, but basically they find out later, they find other Okampans out in space.
Right, and they can survive a lot longer away from that environment,
It's kind of a take on captivity, right? Is the idea that they just don't live as long in captivity, even though the caretaker is trying to keep them alive and means well, because he toasted their planet by accident, but at the end of the day, he's holding them back.
Right.
Right, from really being able to grow.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so the only last piece I wanted to touch on anyway was the Admiral Daugherty. We didn't really talk about him very much. It's kind of a Trek trope where there's the corrupt admiral.
Yeah. That's a huge trope to have the corrupt good guy. Like, we always see the bad cop in TV shows.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, this guy, he even gets the line. He goes, "It was all for the Federation." You know,
right.
But his death was totally deserved. Like, I didn't sit there and weep for that man. I was like, yeah, you earned that one, buddy. Mm-hmm. You, when you make deals with the devil, you don't get to stand at the devil's side for a long time. You eventually become another victim. So,
well, what bothers me is, if this was a Federation mission and he was supposed to be in charge, how come there's not one damn Federation vessel in the Briar Patch?
Yeah.
Not one.
Mm-hmm.
I think my huge issue is they cast somebody who has rough features, who looks like a villain, and he played it up like he was a villain from the beginning. It's it's my issue with Watchmen, too.
I was going to say that. As soon as you start talking.
Ozymandias.
Spoiler alerts for Watchmen.
However you want to say his name, because it is pronounced both ways different times. Matthew Good played that character like he had read the entire script and knew how it was going to end.
Mind.
He wasn't likable at all, and the whole thing was that, like, if you want Daugherty to seem like he is a good character, like he's actually on the Federation, should have had him play it like Kim Cattrall played her character. She seemed very likable in Undiscovered Country. This guy was never likable, and you knew that he was, you know...
That's fair. That's a good
in
point.
Cahoots.
That's my only complaint about Watchmen, as a side note, is that, like, he should have been more noble and square-chinned and look more heroic, because the fact that he's a villain from the
beginning. Don't give him the whole script until you're right about to shoot that scene, like 2 days before or something like that.
Yeah.
Well, so in Insurrection, I think it would have been cool if there had been, like, the Admiral's ship. It could have been a small science vessel, like the Grissom class, like an Oberth class ship. I think... would have been, and then when Raffu gets all pissed off, he just blows it up, you know, I think could have made things a little more dramatic, could have amped things up a little bit, because now
that
he's murdered a couple hundred
people.
That would have given
the Sona more characteristics, too, like, that would have given them more development.
Yeah.
And it explains a little bit, because, like, again, like, they straight up say, this planet is in Federation space, this is a Federation mission, the Duck Blind is a Federation Duck Blind, the Admiral is supposed to be in charge, there's no Federation ship anywhere in the sector, right?
And conveniently, as always.
Right? So, like, you could have had something. You give me an Oberth class or, you know, a Miranda class vessel. It's a science ship because it's a science mission.
Yeah.
Right? That can't defend itself against a Sona warbird, war vessel, whatever you call it.
Well, even at the beginning, when Data uncovers that hidden building, you're telling me that those, like, 20-something officers are living in that building and that's it? Like, they've never stepped foot outside of it? How long have they been there? Where are their...
Well, they were staying on Raffu's ship.
Oh, okay.
Because
But they easily could have had a Federation ship, too.
Absolutely.
Like,
because that's the thing, because at the end, you know, they separate the Federation officers from the rest of the population.
Yeah.
Right? Those were the other Federation officers that were in the Duck Blind and everything like that. So,
right.
You know, it's one of those things where they could have had a straight-up science vessel that could not defend itself, just like they did in Star Trek III, right? And have him blow it up to really push him over the edge. Because having him do the wishy-washy trying to convince Picard at the end, like, at what, like, does he really think Picard's gonna buy that? He might as well just go full bad guy.
Yeah.
And be done with it, you know?
Double down at that point.
Right. So, that's just me.
No, but I'm with you on that.
Any final thoughts, then, on Insurrection?
No, I'm really excited to watch Nemesis.
Again.
Yeah.
I have mixed feelings. It. But yeah, I am excited to see with a new lens of based on our conversations the last 3 weeks now.
Yeah, yeah. So we will be doing Nemesis next week. So, you know, if you haven't seen it and it hasn't been spoiled for you by now, then, you know.
What rock have you been living under?
Be aware of that. So we will be back for that next week. Guys, where can people get a hold of you out in the social media verse?
We've clicked our tongues simultaneously.
Wow, that's impressive.
Both of us talking at the same time. I'm Siren Ray. I am a cosplayer majority of the time. I can't speak anymore. That's what I'm doing, though. All my stuff's costumes and movie news and trash talk, so join me for that on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook.
And at AvengersZS is my Twitter handle, so you can find me there. Probably posting about my cat and or Star Trek at this point.
And I am the Star Trek dude. You can also find Ray and I on Screen Heroes, which is the Heroes Podcast Network's TV and movie podcast. So you can check us out there. You can also follow this show at Red Shirts Pod on Twitter if you are into this type of thing. Don't forget to please subscribe to the show. Drop us a review. If you do drop us a review, I'll give you a shout out on the show. It doesn't even have to be 5 stars. Just, you know, don't be too mean, you know, be honest. Criticism is totally fine if you're not a jerk about it. But we hope you enjoyed the show. We will be back next week to review Star Trek Nemesis. So we will catch you guys next time.
Live long and prosper.
Red Shirts and Runabouts is part of the Heroes Podcast Network. The show is hosted by myself, Gregory Bosco, along with Jeremy Munkin and Derek Mayer. The theme song is by Flying Killer Robots. You can find us, as well as other Heroes Podcast Network shows, at heroespodcast.com, as well as on iTunes, Blog Talk Radio, Google Play, and anywhere you can use an RSS feed. Follow us on social media at Heroes Podcast on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitch. And you can also email us at contact@heroespodcast.com. Engage.